Muslims worldwide are celebrating the last day of Ramadan today.
And Muslims in America are perhaps also celebrating the end of a plan to burn the Quran on Saturday.
We have agreed to cancel our event on Saturday.
That's Pastor Terry Jones backing away from his Quran burning day.
But here's the beginning of that sentence.
The Imam has agreed to move the mosque. We have agreed to cancel our event on Saturday.
What happens if Jones learns the Islamic Cultural Center is not moving?
Can a cancellation then be canceled? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. The best laid plans of a Florida pastor are a bit of a mystery this morning. It's Friday, September 10th.
And that story's at the top of the news. Demonstrations in Kabul this morning. Hundreds burned effigies and chanted death to America in response to that church in Florida that was planning to burn copies of the Quran tomorrow on the anniversary of September 11th. The man in the middle of that controversy, Reverend Terry Jones, says he'll cancel the event if he can reach an agreement with Muslim leaders in New York.
I was told exactly that the Imam would move the mosque from ground zero. I was told he cannot move it tomorrow. I said that is fine, but it cannot be in 10 years.
The meeting between the two is being mediated by Florida's an imam from Florida, Muhammad Musri, who yesterday appeared alongside Pastor Jones. Musri says there's no deal on the mosque move. He told our partner, the BBC, he could only arrange a meeting in New York to discuss the pastor's concerns.
I said I listened to the imam's interview on CNN last night, and the imam expressed that he is thinking and he is sensitive to the feelings of the families of the victims of 9/11. He is going to give it a lot of thought, but he has no plans to change anything at this time.
We're going to have more on this story coming up in a moment.
A federal judge has ruled the military's policy barring openly gay service members, known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, it's unconstitutional. Judge Virginia Phillips says the policy infringes the fundamental rights of the U.S. service members in many ways, from substantive due process to free speech. The judge says she will draft an injunction today to stop the military from enforcing the policy.
The fire chief in San Bruno, California, now says at least six people have been killed after a massive explosion sent flames through a neighborhood just south of San Francisco. San Bruno's mayor, Jim Ruane, says the fire is the most devastating event to ever happen in his city.
I would ask anybody who sees this to say a special prayer for those people. This is going to be a long haul for the city and all of our residents for a number of weeks to come.
The fire was caused when a gas line ruptured, causing a fireball to go more than 1,000 feet in the air. And officials in Boulder, Colorado, say the four-mile fire is moving west toward more homes and away from valleys. That's prompting new evacuations of 10,000 residents. Heavy winds are hindering firefighters' efforts. It could be days before the blaze is fully contained.
The United Nations official in charge of emergency relief says more aid money is needed for Pakistan. The UN has only received two-thirds of its $460 million goal for the country. Most Americans still don't eat enough fruits and vegetables, according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. It finds that less than a quarter of all Americans get the recommended amount of vegetables, and just over a third get enough fruit. Asian markets are up. European indices are down, not really reacting to the dietary information there. Futures are up on Wall Street. The Dow gets underway at 10,415. The S&P opens at 1,104. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,236. We're asking for your reaction to the Burn a Quran Day plans that are a bit of a mystery. What do you think?
Miles Harris from Gardner, Massachusetts. I think the blame for the whole mosque controversy and the Quran burning lies in whoever started the original mosque controversy and made such a big deal about that. And politicians that use these issues to start people to get angry should be taking the blame.
Get the conversation started at 8778-MY-TAKE.
In the meantime, we'll have a conversation about the symbolic meaning of the Quran and compare it with other holy books, including the Bible.
Good morning, everyone. A crazy story? I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
A tantalizing story that involves all kinds of cultural themes.
Frustrating story in some ways.
And frustrating because we don't really know what's going on. First, there was a postponement of the Quran burning, as we talked about in the newscast.
Well, first a cancellation, right?
Right. Cancellation because there was a deal on the Lower Manhattan mosque, but then nobody else knows about this deal but Terry Jones. In any case, he's now got plans on hold, and we'll find out more today. President Obama will no doubt refer to this or maybe dodge the question at his news conference later today.
And then military officials are expected to speak as well, as I understand.
We thought this was an opportunity to take a look at a book as an object. Certainly using a book as an object to burn and then inflame an entire sort of cultural religious group is what Terry Jones is trying to do here, or has succeeded to do, no matter what he's trying to do, has some historical connotations.
It has historical echoes, that's for sure.
There's also this interesting narrative of what is a church. A church constitutes a different kind of object in Christianity than it does in Islam, than it does in Judaism.
Yes.
So to look at these themes among all of the peoples of the book, because that's really the participants in this controversy that's playing itself out in Florida and in New York, we've asked sort of student and master to join us, Reza Aslan, contributing editor at The Daily Beast. He's author of No God But God, Beyond Fundamentalism, and How to Win a Cosmic War, God, Globalization, and the End of the War on Terror. Reza, good morning and welcome back to the program.
Good morning.
Also, Harvey Cox, the Hollis Research Professor of Divinity at Harvard University, he joins us. Professor Cox, good morning to you.
Good morning.
I understand Reza actually was your student at one point.
Yes, he was. A very good one, too.
Well, let's get both of your voices involved here. Reza, as you look at this situation, what is the history of the Quran as an object that can be desecrated in some way and thereby inflame all Muslims? Because that's really not the case for the Bible and Christians.
Well, you have to understand that Muslims have a different relationship to the Quran than Christians do to the New Testament. It's actually very much like what the relationship between Jews and the Torah, in that they believe that the scripture is actually endowed with the spirit of the divine. In other words, the very words on the page, the letters themselves, have the power of God in them. And so the desecration of the book, the physical book, is in some ways an act of blasphemy towards the divine. That's quite different, of course, than the way that many Christians view the New Testament.
Professor Harvey Cox, Terry Jones says, we're not hurting anyone, we're just burning a book. Does the different relationship between Christians and the Bible make it difficult for Americans perhaps to understand exactly what the provocation is here?
Well, I think it does, and I think that Ross is right that the equivalent here is not the Bible and the Quran. The Quran is more like the figure of Jesus, and the Bible is the secondary interpretation of the figure of Jesus Christ himself. So it doesn't have quite the central position in Christianity that the Quran has for Muslims. It's also important that to realize that the Quran, at least the Muslims believe, is one voice. It's the voice of God, given to Muhammad. Whereas the Bible the word means library. It's a collection of dozens and dozens of different kinds of literature, dating over hundreds of years, bound together in one particular book. But it's different in its nature from the Quran. There have been Bible burnings in the past,
sure.
People who have done that, but this is the first time I know of a Quran burning.
So are you saying that for Christians to truly understand the meaning of this, the meaning of the burning of the Quran, they'd have to imagine the burning of an image of Jesus Christ?
Like a cross burning or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, even more, yes. That would get closer.
Harvey Cox, let's talk a little bit about the church, and I want to get back to you, Reza, as well. The idea of the church is different in Christianity than in Islam and Judaism, and I remember growing up in the Christian church hearing that the church is everywhere. It doesn't constitute an actual building. That's also distinct from these other peoples of the book. Harvey?
Yeah, well, I think that's true. You can ask Reza, of course, about the understanding of the ummah. The congregation, the people who constitute the Islamic faith, there are some similarities between the worldwide church, let's say, as the body of Christ, and the Ummah in Islam. They're similar in that respect. And both of them are very diverse. There are all kinds of branches and sects within them. They're not uniform.
So, Reza, is the moving of a mosque more significant in some sense than the moving of a church to Muslims?
No, quite the contrary. A mosque is not a temple. It's not a holy place. There's nothing sacred about a mosque. Mosque comes from the word masjid, which literally means a gathering place. In other words, anywhere where more than two Muslims come together in order to pray is by definition a mosque, which is why calling the Park 51 Project, the Islamic Community Center in Lower Manhattan, a mosque is incorrect. Yes, there is amongst these 13 floors an empty open space where Muslims can pray, and yes, by definition, that would be considered a mosque, but really the project itself is much more like a YMCA than anything else. And this term mosque at Ground Zero, which was deliberately used in order to inflame passions against this project, is definitely an incorrect way of thinking about it.
Well, we should note that there was a Quran burning in Washington, D.C. back in 2008, so Terry Jones isn't the first to use the Quran as a provocation. Harvey Cox, before we go, where do you think this moment is headed?
Well, I hope it's headed towards some kind of a learning moment for a lot of people in this country to realize how important the Quran is to Muslims, and I hope it's also instructive that hundreds and thousands of Christian and Jewish religious leaders have urged this gentleman not to burn the Quran, and that would be an indication to Muslims around the world and to Christians as well that this is just not something that you should do, and I certainly hope and pray he doesn't do it.
All right, your voice is joined by a lot of people who will be watching, including the president, who I think will have words about this later on today. Harvey Cox is the Hollis Research Professor of Divinity at Harvard University. Reza Aslan, contributing editor at the Daily Beast, author of No God But God: Beyond Fundamentalism and How to Win a Cosmic War. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following.
Don't Ask, Don't Tell has been ruled unconstitutional. A federal judge in California struck down the military's 17-year policy of allowing gays to serve in the military only if they do not disclose their sexual orientation. Judge Virginia Phillips' ruling says the policy violates due process and free speech. She'll draft an injunction to stop the military from enforcing the policy. The Justice Department has a week to respond. Colorado firefighters continue to battle the Four Mile Canyon fire, a wildfire spanning 10 square miles in the Rocky Mountain foothills. Nearly half of the blaze has been contained so far. No more homes have been lost since Wednesday. And Terry Jones, just on Good Morning America, said, "Right now we have no plans to do it." He's referring to the burning of the Quran tomorrow. "We believe the imam is going to keep his word that he promised us yesterday." That promise was to move the Islamic Cultural Center in Manhattan. "We believe that we are, as he said, and promised, going to meet with the imam in New York tomorrow." That's the comments of Pastor Terry Jones, the pastor out of Gainesville, Florida, speaking on Good Morning America.
In Taiwan, a mass wedding for 163 couples yesterday. The group ceremony took place at 9:09 a.m. on the ninth day of the ninth month on the 99th year of the founding of the republic. Kind of a feng shui thing. Why? In Chinese, the word for nine sounds like the word for longevity, making it an auspicious occasion. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. What have we learned about in this controversy over the possibly canceled Quran burning and the possible meeting between Terry Jones and the imam in Lower Manhattan? Listeners have been calling. You can weigh in, too. Our number, of course, 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. So before we hear the voice of that clergyman from Gainesville, Florida, on this very interesting battle that's going on in Florida and New York and heard around the world, let's hear your voices responding to this situation.
imagine if the tables were reversed, if instead it was an Islamic member of society who was burning the Holy Bible.
Harvey Cox addressed that moments ago in our segment about what the significance of the Bible is versus the significance of the Quran. This is Aaron from Stillwater, Oklahoma, who also called us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The government would be after him in 2 seconds, and he would be considered a terrorist. Why is it that in America, the religion of Christianity and the race of white gets you away with a lot of things that otherwise you would get in trouble for?
Marissa from Staten Island, New York, texts us that the pastor's about-face, or apparent about-face, shows, quote, that even our closed-minded religious fanatics are more understanding and reasonable than the moderate imam who won't change his mind about building the mosque. We may learn more about that later today. A lot of people thought the whole story is just a publicity stunt there in Florida. Richard wrote on our Facebook page, excessive media coverage over a potential juvenile stunt wasted a lot of our time. From Woonsocket, Rhode Island, Alan texted us to say, we should have learned the press and the government are directing our attention away from the economy. And after this controversy and the one facing the proposed Islamic Center and mosque near Ground Zero, many of our listeners reached out and sounded like this voice, Jessica from Columbia, South Carolina.
It's not right. It was not Islam that committed the crimes of 9/11. It was people who were crazy, just like the people that want to burn the Quran down in Florida. Not right. We shouldn't preach hate. We need to be together.
How to get together. Give us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or any aspect of this story we're interested. Post a comment at thetakeaway.org.
This controversy is not the only thing going on in New York right now. We still have the U.S. Open, and the singles tournament is heading into the semifinal rounds today. In last night's quarterfinals, tennis's number one Rafael Nadal defeated his fellow Spaniard, Fernando Verdasco. Amy Eddings, host of All Things Considered on WNYC, New York Public Radio, was there, has been watching the tournament religiously, right, Amy?
Oh, yeah.
And she
religiously.
Joined...
I love that. That's good.
I bow down
good
to
segue.
The big screen
yeah,
TV.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So... reason tells us that Nadal's not going to have a hard time in this match. Is that true?
Meaning against Mikael Yuzhny?
Yeah.
Yes, yes. Head-to-head, Nadal has Yuzhny's number 7-4. The last time they met up was 2008, Wimbledon. Nadal took him in straight sets. I just think Nadal has more experience in the bigger matches. He's been here before in a semifinal at the U.S. Open. This is his third consecutive time here. This is new for Mikael Yuzhny. He's having a great year, a great run, but I just don't think he can beat Rafa Nadal.
But last night was very emotional, having beat, you know, his fellow Spaniard there. In fact, at one point, Verdasco burst into tears. Is that correct?
Well, he was rubbing dirt out of his eyes a lot last night, and that was in part because of the wind. He was really defeated by the wind as much as by his fellow countrymen who took him in straight sets. This was the first time Nadal dropped serve in the entire tournament. 16 unforced errors for Nadal versus 41 for Verdasco. He kept messing around with his service toss because of the wind. A lot of players have been having that problem. It's a real vortex down there in Arthur Ashe Stadium.
I love the Spaniards, though. They're all so emotional. See, it's not like just
he
angry.
He was rubbing
like
dirt out of his eyes.
Oh, yeah. Well, did you see the final, the match point? That, you know, Verdasco was beaten by the wind, but remember, he had played this in 4-hour, 23-minute, 5-setter against another countryman, David Ferrer, and his winning point was this amazing shot that he scrambled for, this hard backhand volley that Ferrer gave him. He lifts it up and over the net post and drops it in the only place that it could drop in for a winner, right near the baseline, falls backward onto the court.
So
Ferrer
great.
Lifts him up and gives him a hug. It was great, great tennis. But then he comes in this round with Nadal and the wind gets him.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Let's talk about the women. They've got their semifinal matches this afternoon. We have one American left at this point. That is Venus Williams. Out of these four women, who do you see advancing?
Caroline Wozniacki, the Dane, is looking
really
strong. You know, remember, the first three matches she played, she only dropped three games. She beat Vera Zvonareva in Montreal in straight sets. Mm. She's got a great incentive to win. If Wozniacki wins, she could pick up another $1 million to her paycheck. She won the Olympus U.S. Open Series. Zvonareva, a bit of a meltdown diva. Wozniacki has it all over her in terms of mental toughness. Venus Clijsters, Kim Clijsters, the Belgian, the defending champion. That's a little bit more interesting. Head-to-head, they've both won, I believe, six games apiece against each other. Last year, they had a weird up-and-down match. 6-love, love 6, 6-4, I think, in the quarterfinals. Clijsters won that. This could be a real emotional get-back match for
Kleister's
beat
Serena,
little sister Serena last year in a semifinal in which Serena also, of course, famously beat herself by that foot fault and then that subsequent meltdown and yelling at a lineswoman that had her defaulted out of the match. So this could be interesting if Venus
Big
takes
sister
this.
Will take care
That's
of it.
Well,
That's
let's take care of it, Serena.
Let's talk Great. About Roger Federer and the men's semifinals. What do we see happening here?
Well, he's taking on Novak Djokovic. That could be tough. Federer has a winning record over Djokovic, but their matches have been really tough.
They have.
And Djokovic is looking really strong. But, you know, if it goes to a five-setter, I just don't think Djokovic has the training and conditioning that Federer does.
He's a great personality, though, Djokovic.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you see Nadal and
I'm really
Federer.
Gunning for a Nadal-Federer final, and I'm hoping Nadal wins it and wins his first U.S. Open championship and gets his career Grand Slam.
Okay, so Amy Eddings is hoping for a Federer-Nadal matchup, and she's hoping for in the women's side?
Ooh, that's good. Kleister's Wozniacki. I'd like to see Kleister's winning. I'd like to see Kleister's
I love
do it
Amy.
Again.
You know, Ibrahim comes in here and his predictions are kind of like, oh, I don't know. Amy's just like, boom, 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 boom. Yeah.
She knows what she wants. Yeah, she's right. A woman that knows what she wants, at least where tennis is concerned. Amy Eddings is the host of All Things Considered on WNYC New York Public Radio. She will be watching the semifinals in the U.S. Open.
I'll actually be at one of those semifinals. My
wife
will be up at 10 o'clock. We're zooming out there.
That's exciting. We continue our conversation about the Burn a Quran Day that was planned for tomorrow and may not go forward now. We're going to talk to a minister who's also in Gainesville, Florida, and get his take on the situation in a moment. That's coming up. But here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. People around the world keeping a close eye on that tiny church in Gainesville this morning. Will the pastor go through with its plan to burn copies of the Quran? Yesterday, he said this.
As of right now, we have just put a temporary hold upon our planned event.
Muslim leaders say no such conversation or agreement to move the mosque ever took place and called the pastor's comments misleading. They're talking about the proposed deal Terry Jones has referred to, in which he says an imam promised they would move the Islamic Cultural Center in New York if he canceled the Burn a Quran Day event. The Obama administration is encouraging a new power-sharing plan in Iraq. Under the plan, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki would remain in his job but have his authority curbed significantly. That compromise was promoted by Vice President Biden while he was in Baghdad last week.
Some disagreement between the president and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton were observing this morning. President Obama backed away from some remarks that Secretary Clinton had earlier this week, where she compared the drug cartel violence in Mexico to an insurgency in Colombia, a 20-year insurgency in Colombia earlier in the week. In an interview with La Opinion magazine in Los Angeles, the president says the two are not comparable. The White House denies there's any daylight, though, between the president and the Secretary of State. Let's check the markets. Asian markets up. European indices down. Futures are up on Wall Street. The Dow starts at 10,415. The S&P at 1,104. The NASDAQ at 2,236. Some of the stories we're following this morning.
So it is a little confusing, but let me try and clarify it as much as is possible. Pastor Terry Jones of the church in Florida that had planned a Burn the Quran Day for the anniversary of September 11th, last night announced he canceled his plans to hold the Quran burning in Gainesville. But then he learned that the Islamic Cultural Center would not be moved from its location in New York, and so the pastor said his event was simply on hold. All the while this was going on, Jones is appearing on the major news networks in the United States and many around the globe, and he also took a phone call from the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. Joining us this morning to help us kind of meditate on what all this means is Dan Johnson. He joins us again. He's a minister at Trinity United Methodist Church. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm wondering if you have more clarity than we do about whether or not this event will occur tomorrow.
You know, maybe it's the cynical side of me. How can anyone have clarity with this person we're dealing with? Oh, my goodness. I don't. I haven't checked the news this morning. I don't know other than what you've said. It's still very disturbing.
I wonder what is your reaction to the Terry Jones idea that he will cancel his event in exchange for the imam in New York agreeing to move the Islamic Cultural Center there? Do you think that's a reasonable bargain?
My first reaction is you got to be kidding me. I mean, who would let this person be a key negotiator at any sort of major event? I mean, it's absurd. I just can't get my mind around it.
You know, you said on this program yesterday, Dan, that America is yearning and hungering for moderate voices and that the fringe is holding America hostage. Do you think this negotiation and even the presence by Secretary Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, by calling Terry Jones, is part of a kind of hostage situation that's developing?
Yeah, I think we've gotten to that, and I think Gates did the right thing. He had, but to move on then and nobody in their right mind would let this person be in a negotiation process. That's just way beyond. And we've got to step back once this is over and figure out how not to get in this position again. It's a terrible position.
Well, let me ask you about your ideas on how we not to get in this position again. As I understand, you've been approached by reporters who've, discussed with you the ethics of coverage on this particular issue. Do you feel like that the problem here was just that it got too much media attention?
Honestly, I do, and I don't quite know the answer there, how to navigate that, because I know news people need to cover things, but I know all those reporters standing around where, of course, they're out there in the hot sun debating, and they're just asking themselves, this doesn't make sense. Why are we here? What is the ethics of us doing this, covering four people? Really, you're talking about four people who are holding everybody else in hostage. If it hadn't been reported, it would have been a non-event.
Well, let me ask you, as a minister at the Trinity United Methodist Church, you must have members of your congregation coming to you with their own concerns over this controversy, or maybe coming to you with their own concerns over some of the discussions about Muslim Americans and the place of Islam in the United States. What do you advise them?
Well, you know, we're in a university town. Most of our folks are very ecumenical, as it were, and appreciative of people of different faiths. So they're real positive about Islamic people. So it's not so much advising. They're just wringing their hands over what to do about somebody who'd been a thorn in our side, but just a small irritant who became a huge irritant.
Pastor Johnson, let's go back to the issue of the media for a moment. And I think a lot of mainline churches and others have criticized the media for its general coverage of religion. And here we've got a situation where this one guy with 50 members of a congregation gets a world stage. If you were going to design the coverage, what voices would you want to hear, do you think, are not getting into this? What people should get their place in the sun to make a counter argument right now?
You mean now where we are?
Well, yeah, religious voices.
Well, I've been grateful that the news media has been pretty open to covering, like, for example, our event, which is this peace gathering for peace, understanding, and hope. I mean, I'm grateful that's been out there. This thing has gotten so to the place where it's a sort of a minor piece in there. And I suppose, to your point, we moderates need to present a lot of positive things, and hopefully you all will pick it up. Unfortunately, positive things that we're doing, relief and human kindness, don't seem to capture the headlines for some reason, like a strange person wanting to burn the Quran.
Well, so what you got to do, Dan Johnson, is get your congregation together with pictures of Terry Jones and offer to burn those and watch the satellite trucks come to your door.
I don't think we'll do that.
Well, I'm wondering.
Thanks for the suggestion.
I'm wondering how you feel this has contributed to discussions or the relationship between Christians and Jews and people of all faith, Muslims in the United States. Do you think that this particular event, whether it got too much media coverage or no, do you think it's contributed to more discussions, to better understanding, or less?
It's like a lot of things. It can exacerbate relationships and make them worse, or for well-intentioned people, and that's happening. A number of people at one of our gatherings the other day said, well, we ought to be thankful that this happened because we're gaining understanding. So there is some of that. There's going to be what really needs to happen in this country is a deeper look at Islam to see its multiple variations of Islam and a greater understanding of different faiths. I have a friend who used to work some with the State Department. He said it was official policy, if I remember, for the State Department in Middle East negotiations not to talk about religion. Well, I mean, how can you possibly do Middle East relationships and not talk about religion? So I think we need to have a better way of talking about our religious differences. And so this may open that up. Let's pray that it does.
Well, you can always talk about the weather. The weather's always a safe topic, Dan Johnson.
I know. That won't get the trucks out either.
Well, that's certainly true. Dan Johnson, minister at Trinity United Methodist Church, thanks so much for joining us. We want you to keep this conversation going for you. What is your takeaway from this whole thing?
So the nutcase gets all the media attention he wants. The media is now saying, how did we let this happen? And now all the attention and all the focus is going to be on, how do we stop this from happening again? The media continues to make this a story, while at the same time saying, how did we let this become a story? I don't get it.
I don't get it either. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. At what point does a car bomb stop being a relic of a crime and become art? A rusting, crumpled car that was salvaged from the 2007 bombing of the historic Al-Mutanabi Street Book Market in Baghdad that killed 38 people is now on display at London's Imperial War Museum. It's being presented by the Turner Prize-winning artist Jeremy Deller. It's called Baghdad, 5 March 2007. It's been featured previously in his U.S. project, It Is What It Is. We're joined now by Roger Tolson. He's the head of collections at London Imperial War Museum. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, first of all, what attracted your museum to featuring this particular piece?
Because it's an extraordinary object, and it tells so many really important stories about contemporary conflict and its impact on citizens. It's an object from the conflict in Iraq, and we're, as a museum, trying to collect all aspects of conflict, its impact on individuals, on society, on nations, and this particular object is full of resonances, full of stories.
Well, can you tell me, has Jeremy Deller altered the car in any way?
No, not at all. Not deliberately, actively. It's not a work of art. It is an exhibit, like any other exhibit we have in our main atrium. We have tanks and we have planes on display. And this crumpled and very fragile piece of twisted metal just sits there amongst all these shiny military equipment. It's a very disarming piece. Jeremy took it on tour, as you mentioned, and it's been shaken about a bit, but it's not been distorted or altered in any deliberate way.
And have you gotten reaction from people who've come and seen it?
We have, almost immediately. We opened the doors to the public yesterday at 10 to the and it's the first object that our visitors see as they walk into the museum in London. One of the first visitors in, a very elderly man, was staring at it for a long time, looking at me, reading the interpretation, and I entered into conversation with him, and he said, "This object doesn't make me feel good." And I think that's exactly it. It's a disturbing piece, and it's important for us to be telling the story about the impact of conflict, and it's been a... You know, although it's a disturbing piece, the reaction from people I've spoken to so far about us displaying it has been overwhelmingly positive.
I did read one comment from a visitor who said that having it at the front of the museum changed their view of all of the other things in the museum and the tanks and other weaponry that they saw as they went into the war museum, that seeing the car first made them think first about the consequences of war.
If that's what they said, that is a... For me, is what we try to achieve. I think it's great that people have been able to articulate that. It's a very, very exciting project for the museum.
How long will it be there?
We'll have it on display in London until Easter next year, and then it goes to our museum in Manchester. It's now part of our permanent collection, so we'll be planning to display it as frequently as we can.
Donated by the New Museum in New York. We just spoke with Roger Tolson. He's the head of collections at London's Imperial War Museum, where they are now displaying a car that was salvaged from the 2007 bombing in Baghdad that killed 38 people. Thank you so much, Roger.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Let's check leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Florida Pastor Terry Jones tells ABC's Good Morning America that his planned 9/11 Quran burning won't go forward, and he says he believes Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf will move his proposed Islamic Community Center from Lower Manhattan.
Right now, we have plans not to do it. We believe that the Imam is going to keep his word, what he promised us yesterday.
This, of course, contradicts what Rauf's spokespeople are saying about any plans for changing the location of that mosque in Lower Manhattan. We'll continue following this story all morning. President Obama holds a news conference at the White House at 11. And after talking about the economy for most of the week, he's expected to officially name Austin Goolsbee as the new chairman of his Council of Economic Advisors. He will most likely address the Quran-burning controversy and the Lower Manhattan situation as well.
Iran says it's releasing one of the three American hikers detained last summer when they crossed over the Iraqi border. Tehran has accused the hikers of entering illegally and having links to U.S. intelligence. No word on the fates of the other two captives. And one more about Iran. Officials there have rejected a claim from a dissident group that the country is working on a secret nuclear facility. This after the People's Mujahideen released satellite photos of what it claimed were extensive tunnels. And one of the 29 original Navajo code talkers has died in Arizona. Alan Dale June was part of a team of Native Americans who confounded the Japanese during World War II by developing a code based on their native language. With June's death at age of 91, just two of the 29 originals are still alive. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
So the other big story this morning is that ruling yesterday, district court ruling that the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is unconstitutional. 86-page opinion and ruling from U.S. District Judge Virginia Phillips said the policy does not preserve military readiness. It's contrary to what Justice Department attorneys and many supporters have argued, because evidence shows, according to the ruling, that the policy, in fact, has had a direct and deleterious effect on the armed services. Judge Phillips said she would issue an injunction barring the government from enforcing the policy. The government promptly said it would appeal. Joining us, two familiar voices to help explain what the implications are for the Pentagon and what this ruling actually means. Larry Korb, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, former Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration, also a retired Navy captain. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
Jeffrey Rosen also joins us, whose voice we rely on regularly on this program to explain controversial rulings. He's a George Washington University Law School professor. Good morning, Professor Rosen.
Good morning.
So, first of all, explain this ruling. I was actually surprised by it. It was a two-week trial. The Justice Department defended the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy vigorously, even though the Senate or the House has actually repudiated it. The Pentagon is supposedly ruling on it. What does this ruling actually mean legally from your perspective, Jeffrey Rosen?
It is surprising in the sense that, unlike the recent decisions striking down bans on gay marriage and the Defense of Marriage Act, there's generally a tradition of deference to the military. And here, the judge, relying on Mr. Korb's testimony and others, said that the military's claims that this is necessary for unit cohesion and military readiness are not empirically supportable. And it quoted lots of evidence that people, by concealing their sexual orientation, can't actually form the necessary bonds that are necessary to fight an effective war. It noted that since the war in Afghanistan, discharges under Don't Ask, Don't Tell have plummeted. Recruiting has been harmed by Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And essentially, even under the military's own terms, this was not necessary.
All right, go to the question. All right, so the Pentagon's rationale for it is bogus, according to the ruling, or they can't support it. But the Pentagon can do what it wants. It's internal rules for the Pentagon. They have the authority here. How does this judicial ruling challenge that?
Well, essentially, the judge said that we're not going to give the military deference, even though there are Supreme Court cases that say that we have to defer to the military because fundamental rights recognized by the Supreme Court in the Lawrence case and also fundamental First Amendment rights are involved, then the military has to fall. So the question is, what's so interesting is President Obama was really trying to have this both ways, both criticizing the policy, calling for its repeal, and yet defending it in court. And now his Justice Department has to decide, will it appeal this decision, which creates a division among the circuits? Will it take it all the way up to the Supreme Court? It's going to be harder and harder for President Obama to maintain this balancing act in light of this ruling.
Really interesting legally, really interesting politically, as you've stated there, Jeffrey Rosen. But the Pentagon has some decisions to make, Larry Korb. But what are likely to be the implications of this as Pentagon leaders sort of sketch out what their next steps are?
Well,
I think the Pentagon has already been moving away from it. Secretary Gates basically has said, we're not going to put you out unless we have just on third-party information anymore, and you can't throw somebody out unless it goes up to a flag officer or a general admiral. So that has slowed it down. Both Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, support repealing it, and right now they're doing a study to see how the change would, impact both military people and their families, and that's supposed to be completed by December. I don't think it's going to have a great immediate impact in terms of, the people being thrown out, because as the judge pointed out, it always goes down in wartime anyway, and this is not the first war that this has happened. In fact, in the first Persian Gulf War, Secretary Cheney then suspended all the people who were, about to be thrown out till the war was over. Then they threw them out after it, and so I don't think it's going to have a great immediate impact. And again, I'm not an attorney, so I don't know how long these appeals will take. And I think the real issue is the judge going to say, right now, stop throwing people out, on this basis, and whether in fact that will happen while we go through the appeals process.
Jeffrey, let me ask you, I wanted you to explain a little bit more the unconstitutional argument that the judge made. She said that the don't ask, don't tell policy violated both the Fifth and First Amendments. The First Amendment, you kind of understand, the right to free speech. The Fifth Amendment, can you kind of help us understand how it violates the substantive due process, even though those things are to a certain extent limited or diminished among the military?
Yes, that's a great question, and that's the central issue. The Fifth Amendment right that the court recognized in the Lawrence case said that people have a fundamental right of autonomy to define themselves, to figure out what their conception of intimacy is. And in past cases, the court had said, when the military is involved, you just defer and take their word for whatever they're saying. But the court said, now in light of Lawrence, this right to autonomy is a fundamental right, and it can't be trumped by the military, and the military has no special expertise about what is necessary for unit cohesion and so forth because of this basic right to autonomy. So we're really seeing dramatically the effect of this Lawrence decision. That was at the center of the California gay marriage decision. It's at the center of this decision. That was the case in 2003 where Justice Scalia basically warned, this is going to mean the end of gay marriage and good don't ask, don't tell. And it turns out that he was basically right, because once you've said that moral disapproval is not a legitimate reason for restricting people's behavior, and once you've said people have a basic right to autonomy, then even the military doesn't get deference on this question.
All right.
Really interesting.
So Larry Korb, taking that argument of Jeffrey Rosen, putting the Lawrence decision and this Phillips decision together, if I'm a gay lieutenant in the Marines and this injunction goes into place, I walk into a commanding officer's office and say, hello, I'm gay, there's nothing the Pentagon can do about that, correct?
Well, that's correct. And the thing is, they're already there. Everybody knows it, and we've been, playing this game. That's what the most interesting thing about the case, which I had the privilege of testifying to it. The government didn't call any witnesses because they knew that they would be cross-examined, and it just wouldn't, their testimony wouldn't hold up.
So legally, a decision that is certainly landmark, but possibly part of a trend where we're seeing the end of don't ask, don't tell, ironically predicted by Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court in the Lawrence case. Jeffrey Rosen, George Washington University law professor, thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And Lawrence Korb, who testified in the Phillips case that was ruled on yesterday, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, former Assistant Secretary of Defense during the Reagan administration, and also a retired Navy captain. Larry Korb, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be getting more views on that ruling throughout the morning with people for and against the policy, thinking about how it changes their lives. If you miss any of it, head over to our site, thetakeaway.org.
And while you're there, we've been hearing from a lot of you about Terry Jones, the Gainesville, Florida pastor who had originally planned to host a Quran burning tomorrow. That's now on hold. He is heading to New York to speak with Imam Faisal Abdul-Rauf about the Manhattan Cultural Center instead. But here's what some of you have been saying. Matt in Brooklyn posts, I've learned that if I print up a sign and put it on the side of a trailer, I can get international media attention. And Sarah from Kentucky writes, the fact that this Christian pastor is trying to intimidate Islamic leaders in NYC into giving up their constitutional rights to build a community center sounds like terrorism to me. I believe he's forgotten the golden rule. Would he really be okay with a fellow American burning Christian images, icons, and churches just because they want to threaten Christian leaders into never building a church within a certain radius of government buildings? Comments from you. You can comment yourself at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org.
Pose your own questions. We love it when you do. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
An alleged deal to move a planned New York mosque and a possible agreement on canceling a planned burning of some holy books.
As of right now, we have just put a temporary hold upon our planned event.
Pastor Terry Jones says he found some common ground with Muslim clerics in Florida and New York.
A Quran burning called off, some ministers dare to believe voices of reason can prevail.
I think this country is more eager now than ever to hear moderate voices, and they're tired of hearing the people on the fringe and being taken hostage by people on the fringes so much.
But when this deal on the Manhattan mosque appears to exist only in Pastor Jones' mind, he seems to back off.
We would, of course, be forced to rethink our decision because, like I said, we canceled it based upon his word.
Are we on the edge of reconciliation with a radical Christian mullah from Florida, or is someone trying to hold a mosque hostage in Lower Manhattan? Holy, holy wars, Batman.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It is Friday, September 10th, and people are all abuzz about the pastor in Florida, whether they think we should be talking about him or shouldn't.
Well, there will be more developments today. Let's get a check of the morning's top news. That pastor of the Florida church says he was planning to burn copies of the Quran on September 11th, is now saying this morning he has no plans to go through with the event as of now. Reverend Terry Jones has said if Muslim leaders in New York agreed to move the Islamic Cultural Center and mosque from near ground zero, he would cancel his event. Muslim leaders say no conversation or agreement on that ever took place. Jones tells ABC News this morning his conversation was clear.
I asked him, I said, let me get this perfectly clear. What you are saying is if we cancel our event on Saturday, the mosque will be moved from the ground zero location. And he said, yes, there is absolutely no possibility that I misunderstood him.
Joining us now is Pastor John Fairless of the First Baptist Church down there in Gainesville, Florida. Good morning, Pastor.
Good morning, John and Celeste.
How are you feeling about this confusion? I mean, I think there was a sigh of relief last night, but this morning it's a little bit different. How are you feeling?
Absolutely. Initially, it was a sense of profound relief when we heard that Pastor Jones was going to cancel. That was followed immediately by a very healthy dose of cautious optimism, but now the uncertainty remains. I would say we're on sort of wait and see and perhaps wait and pray duty down here.
The defense secretary, Robert Gates, who apparently called Pastor Jones, do you think that was a positive or a negative here?
Boy, it's a mixed bag. I appreciate the fact that someone so high level and visible as General Petraeus was willing to do that, and the secretary. On the other hand, our feeling is that Pastor Jones lives off of the attention, and you know, the more we glorify his position, the more firmly entrenched he seems to get. So, I just hope somehow it will work and be positive.
Pastor John Fairless of Gainesville, Florida, thanks so much. We're going to be discussing this all morning.
The military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy banning gays from serving openly has been ruled unconstitutional. A federal judge in California struck down the policy, saying it violates substantive due process under the Fifth Amendment. And the government says more than 300 levees, mostly in California and Arizona, have fallen below FEMA accreditation guidelines. The agency will inspect levies from 9 other states before it releases its full report, though. Looking at the markets, Asian markets are up, European indices are down, futures are up. The Dow starts at 10,415, the S&P at 1,104, the NASDAQ at 2,236. So later in the hour, Arianna Huffington joins us in the studio. She's going to talk about her new book in which she says the American middle class is a dying breed. And what does it mean? Does it mean the U.S. could become a third world country? We're going to talk about that later this hour.
And the proposed Quran burning in Florida, it's now on hold. The president will address the nation in a news conference at 11. What kind of a moment is that? We'll discuss it in just a minute. You know, I think it's fair to say that among the takeaways from this whole Florida business is it's an only in America kind of moment.
That's probably true.
Political horse trading in a culture war, only in America. Provoked by one obscure Florida Christian pastor, Terry Jones, only in America. Although some would say only in Florida. I think you said that.
Yes, exactly.
It's drawn in a Florida imam who apparently negotiated some deal with Terry Jones yesterday to meet with Faisal Abdul Rauf, the spiritual leader behind that Islamic center being built in Lower Manhattan. The
yes.
president even weighed in yesterday morning, urging Terry Jones to back down.
This is a recruitment bonanza for Al-Qaeda. I just hope that he says he's someone who is motivated by his faith.
And he says he's praying on it.
Yeah, I hope he listens to those better angels.
The president speaking on Good Morning America yesterday. One of those better angels, it occurred to me.
Probably the only time he's been called this.
Was the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, who actually called Jones personally
yes.
and said that a Quran burning would endanger U.S. troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, amplifying, I think, with his personal phone call, comments made earlier in the week by General David Petraeus.
We're concerned that the images from the burning of a Quran would be used in the same way that extremists used images from Abu Ghraib, that they would, in a sense, be indelible.
It's unclear to us this morning, I think we've mentioned this on more than one occasion today, who's driving this? Is it Terry Jones? Is it Islamic officials concerned with that mosque in Lower Manhattan? Is it the media? Exactly. Does the president have an opportunity? There's a news conference later today. It's going to be streamed live on our website, supposedly.
At 11 a.m.
Convened to talk about the economy. But this is clearly going to come up. What is the opportunity for the president? And what do we make of the Defense Department's weighing in on this matter, both General Petraeus and Secretary of Defense Robert Gates? Todd Zwillick joins us, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning, John.
Also, our old friend, Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent, joining us from London. Good morning, Jonathan.
Yes, good morning, John.
First of all, Todd, what is the opportunity for leadership here for President Obama, or does he just dodge the whole thing?
Well, I don't think he's going to have a chance to dodge the whole thing because of this news conference that you mentioned. And I have a feeling that if the White House thought they wanted to truly dodge the whole thing at this point, they never would have scheduled an East Room news conference for 11 a.m., supposedly to talk about the economy. But we all know that this is going to come up. Look, public opinion is going to be behind the president on this. Most people in the conservative camp, almost everybody, said Korans should not be burned. So he's not going to be out on a limb, but it's pretty clear that the White House would have rather have not dealt with a pastor with 50 followers or 75 or whatever it is. They're only encouraging the next person who wants to get on the world stage from doing the same thing. But in the end, I think it got so close to an actual Quran burning that they had the Secretary of Defense step in to try to put a stop to it, and that's where they're at now.
And that's the really interesting piece for me, Jonathan Marcus. I mean, you've got Bob Gates calling this pastor, essentially utilizing Pentagon skills that have proved very, very effective in finding reconciliation among radical clerics in Iraq and Afghanistan. Gates calls this fellow, it's ironic, it's beyond ironic. It just seems really, really interesting that the Pentagon's been called in here.
Well, it's ironic, of course. I mean, the Pentagon intruded directly, I suppose, when General Petraeus himself became involved. But I think you've got to remember that this story was building throughout the summer months. There were indeed demonstrations against this proposed act in Afghanistan the day before General Petraeus himself spoke. So he was, if you like, I think already responding to a story that was out there, not just out there in America, but out there around the world in many societies, which clearly would respond very violently, perhaps, to this event if it did indeed occur.
Do you think that this Terry Jones is being treated by the Pentagon the same way they treated Muqtada al-Sadr? I mean, obviously they're different in certain respects, but there's a similarity there.
Well, parochial small town Florida is perhaps a very different place. I don't know. But I look, it's a hell of a problem. I mean, it shows you. I mean, if you hear people talking about the global village, it is quite extraordinary that a small town episode like this has been erected into something of a major security concern, not just for right. the United States, one should say, but for all of its allies. It's interesting that all of the countries who have troops in Afghanistan, many of the prominent countries, France, Britain, London, where I'm speaking from, the German government and so on, have all weighed in, making their views about this very, very clear.
They're all very big stakeholders here. That
big
is
stakeholders.
Sure.
And I think also one shouldn't be unaware of the propaganda machine, if you like, of what the American government would call the other side.
Indeed.
I mean, there is a sophisticated propaganda machine out there watching all of this, eager to manipulate and use whatever happens for their own ends. And I think that is clearly part of the equation.
And the president hoping to stop it. Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent. Todd Zwillick, I have to ask you, can the president be a detached kind of mediator here? In some sense, he's part of it all, with all these discussions about whether he's a Muslim and what does his birth certificate say among the American electorate.
Right, and that's the undercurrent of this entire discussion, I think, and I suspect ultimately why the White House got involved in any way in this. Look, John, polls suggest that 30% or more of Americans believe Barack Obama is a Muslim. He isn't. When you're dealing with that reality, I think they had to deal with this in a way that they probably wouldn't have dealt with in another situation.
You should say, when you're dealing with that unreality.
Unreality reality, yeah. which becomes a surreality, which is where we're at here. Look, detached, the White House clearly stepped in here, but they tried to do it in a detached way. The president didn't call anybody. They had the defense secretary call and appeal to Pastor Jones' love of the military, I suppose. Or
and they made it a military argument, not an mm-hmm. ethical one.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Mm-hmm. So on the wires, it's saying that Austin Goolsbee is going to be named the head of the economic advisory team there at the White House at the top of this news conference, but the Quran burning is going to be the first question. Yes or no?
Oh, I think it would probably have to be the first question. Austin Goolsbee, by the way, was not a surprise choice for anyone in Washington, but I think with the way the cable nets are handling this story, with the way we're handling this story, first question comes out. It has to be on the Gainesville situation.
We'll find out. Todd Zwillick, takeaway Washington correspondent, talking about an 11 a.m. Eastern Time news conference of Barack Obama. And Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent. We spoke with them earlier this morning. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following.
Don't Ask, Don't Tell is unconstitutional. That's according to a federal judge in California. She struck down the military's 17-year policy of only allowing gays to serve in the military if they didn't disclose their sexual orientation. Back-to-school season comes at a price for many parents. Public schools around the nation are trying to make up for budget shortfalls, and they're ramping up school fees for things like textbooks, uniforms, and arts programs. But the American Civil Liberties Union of Southern California says the growing fees are unconstitutional. The group is suing the state for failing to protect the right to a free public education. And Mayor Jim Ruane from San Bruno says it'll take some time for the area to recover from the massive fire that broke out after a gas line ruptured last night. Six people died in the blaze.
The worst disaster in that suburb's history, south of San Francisco, right near the San Francisco airport. President Obama has been laying out economic proposals all week. As Todd Zwillick just said, he'll close out the week with a final economic news conference from the White House with a statement. And as we discussed, he's expected to name Austin Goolsbee as the new chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. Capitol Hill employees, by the way, owed $9.3 billion in overdue taxes last year, according to IRS figures. 4% of Capitol Hill workers owe the government money. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Keep the conversation going as we talk through the morning about this Quran burning controversy, the Gainesville affair, as Todd Zwillick called it. What have you learned?
My name is Munib Ahmed. I'm in New York. I'm amazed. How can one man hijack a whole religion, my religion? Tomorrow, so somebody, some other nutcase starts and says, I'm going to burn the Quran. If not, every Muslim has to leave America. How are we going to please those people?
Don't give the nutcases all the attention, all right? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, 877-869-8253.
Well, we would hardly want the story coming out of Gainesville, Florida, about the burning of the Quran to overshadow this other very important news coming out of California. Yesterday, a district court ruled that the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is unconstitutional. In an 86-page opinion, U.S. District Judge Virginia Phillips says the policy does not preserve military readiness. That's contrary to what Justice Department attorneys and many supporters have argued. And instead, the judge says evidence shows the policy, in fact, has had a direct and deleterious effect on the armed services. Joining us now to discuss this is retired Army Colonel David Beatty. Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to examine more this phrase that the judge used, that don't ask, don't tell has a direct and deleterious effect on the armed services. Would you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that. I'm sort of amazed that the judge was able to come to that conclusion based on the fact that that the defense and the Department of Justice in this particular case didn't put forward much of a case at all. So it seems to me that the judge was reacting on based upon evidence put forth by the plaintiffs without due consideration of the other side of the issue.
Well, a couple things that she cited was that Don't Ask, Don't Tell has harmed recruiting for the military, and that for those soldiers who are in the military, it's placed a damper on their morale. In other words, they feel as though they can't be open about what they talk about, whether they are gay or not.
Well, I don't think that there is a sound basis for extending that particular sentiment to all people in the military in terms of whether the effect on their morale. The fact is that the number of homosexuals serving in the military is rather small given the overall size of the military, and so the effects on morale, although there may be localized effects, I have a hard time believing that that is a pervasive problem.
I'm wondering what your reaction is to another part of the ruling. You know, we talked earlier with a law professor who explained that in many court decisions, they defer to the military and say that there are a lot of issues, such as autonomy, in which the military simply knows its needs best. And the judge, in this particular instance, seems to have not bought that argument. Are there cases in which there are military issues that a civilian court can't truly understand?
Well, I think in this particular case, there are issues that a civilian court cannot fully appreciate. It goes beyond the citing of social science statistics that the plaintiff side undoubtedly put forward in this case. There are the military culture in and of itself is quite different than the culture that most judges live in. The necessity of people working closely together, and I'm not just talking about the soldiers, sailors, and airmen and Marines, but I'm also talking about the conditions of life within military communities themselves is quite a bit different. And although a judge can certainly understand that, I think that it's not something that is a matter of second nature. And once again, a full presentation of that case probably would have allowed this judge to better understand what was going on. And for example, the Department of Defense right now is doing a very thorough job of querying the force concerning the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And that's data has not been released. Those studies have not been released yet. It seems rather premature to draw conclusions without this very important data set available.
Well, we'll see. I'm sure the case is probably going to proceed even further up. That is retired Army Colonel David Beatty speaking to us about the decision out of the California District Court ruling that the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is unconstitutional. Well, joining us now is Arianna Huffington. She's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of the Huffington Post. Her new book is called very provocatively, as I said before, Third World America, how our politicians are abandoning the middle class and betraying the American dream. Before we get to some of the issues that you bring up in your book, which are extremely fascinating, I wanted to get your response to the conversation we've been having all morning about the pastor in Florida, the event with the burning of the Quran, the involvement of President Obama and the Department of Defense. What is your takeaway from this situation?
Well, first of all, I'm stunned by the amount of attention that the media have given to it. I mean, I was on CNN yesterday to discuss the middle class, and of course there was nothing but breaking news about a nutcase with 50 followers maximum who has dominated our media coverage. And I could not help thinking that if we were giving 10% of that attention to what's happening around the country, to telling stories, which is part of our job as people in the media, we would actually be doing something for this country. And the other sort of irony here is that you have Petraeus and Gates and everybody worrying about this would do to the troops, while we have reports today about all the Predator drones, the latest Predator drones attacks that are killing civilians and wounding hundreds. What is that doing to the safety of the troops? What is that doing to increasing the kind of hatred towards America?
No, that's a good point. Do you think it plays politically in the 2010 off-year election, this whole distorted kind of mess?
I think what it's playing politically is, unfortunately, the way in which more and more people are responding from their lizard brains to events.
Lizard
which,
brains.
Yes, which is what happens during periods of economic anxiety. Instead of responding rationally, people are responding irrationally, including to the building of the mosque in New York. So that's my biggest concern, because then sort of demagogues can exploit anything.
Well, we're going to delve deeper into your economic theories and what you think the Americans should actually be paying attention to in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break. Arianna Huffington, co-founder, editor-in-chief of The Huffington Post. We'll talk more in a moment. We are back again with Arianna Huffington. She is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Huffington Post. She's written many books, but her latest is called Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. And I want to start by asking you about that title. You must have known people would be upset by comparing America to a third world country. And I'm wondering if you were serious about that, if you feel that's where we're headed.
Yes, I know it's a jarring phrase. I know it's very much contrary to our conviction that America is the greatest nation on earth, the most noble, the most generous, and very much still contrary to many people's experience. But the reason why I wanted to use this title is because I feel this is the trajectory we are on, and because we still have a window to prevent it. And so it's really important to sound the alarm in a way that will get people's attention so we do the things that will course correct.
Well, I wanted to kind of pick apart exactly what you think has happened to the middle class, because you trace it back to Ronald Reagan, and you're not partisan. You don't exempt either Democrats or Republicans from criticism here, but you blame Reagan, Clinton, Bush, and the Obama administration for contributing or allowing the death of the middle class to go forward. Could you explain how this has all started?
It's really kind of the takeover of our political system by special interests. And the fact that now powerful interests can buy public policy, we see it again and again. And we see the impact this has had on the middle class. Elizabeth Warren calls them tricks and traps that have been put in our mortgage contracts, in our credit card contracts. You can trace back, for example, the skyrocketing 28-30% credit card interest rates to a 1978 Supreme Court decision that made it possible for credit card companies to charge the interest rate of the state where they are incorporated instead of the state where they're actually offering the credit cards. And as a result, they're in Delaware, which has eliminated usury laws so they can offer these teaser interest rates to our kids as they start college. I have a kid who is a freshman this year. And then in the small print of these 28, 29-page contracts, you discover that, in fact, they can put them up to 29%.
And this the application is just a tear-off, really, there at college, right,
from a
bulletin board.
So this is like one small example of what has been happening.
Well, another example that you say is the takeover of our system, that we're not producing goods anymore, that we have financial services producing nothing. And in fact, you quote someone who said, what is bad for Wall Street at this point would be good for America.
Well, what's happening is that we went from a country that makes things to a country that makes things up. You know, credit default swaps, toxic derivatives with fancy names that CEOs told us after the financial meltdown they couldn't really understand. So that we've seen, you know, and I have the data in the book, how the financial industry has begun to take a bigger and bigger percentage, both of corporate profits and of GDP. So instead of being, you know, enabling the real economy, it's become sort of an alternative to the real economy. So we have this two-tier economy now, where Wall Street is thriving and Main Street is suffering.
Well, you could say three-tier if you include the sort of military-industrial complex. It's also grown in the same period of time, and as we've had these sort of open-ended wars during Bush and now the Obama administration. But let's get back to what seems to be a real puzzle to me. How much of this is political, and how much of this is sort of the end of the American century? Hillary Clinton talked about a new American moment. Many would say that what's happening to the middle class in the United States already happened in the UK. The end of the empire produced a huge financial boost to London, but the manufacturing sort of presence and the traditional middle class has declined. So you can go to places in England where it does seem like a third world country. That's what's happening here, and there's nothing politics can do about it.
There's nothing inevitable about it, though. I quote Arnold Toynbee in the book, who said that empires die much more frequently from suicide than murder. So we are bringing it on ourselves. And you're right that a characteristic of the end of an empire seems to be always, going back to the Romans, military adventures abroad that we cannot afford and we certainly do not need. We now are spending $2 billion a week on Afghanistan, a war that is certainly not making us more secure, a war that is unwinnable, a war where we cannot even define the objective, a war where we are basically buttressing a corrupt regime.
Well, let me ask you, you do tell some story. I mean, you have a little bit of condemnation for the media as well as politicians in your book. And you say that part of the problem is that we haven't spent any time telling the stories of the human faces on the recession. The couple of them really stuck in my mind. You told the story about a couple that got divorced only because, as divorced couple, she could collect her Social Security widow's benefits. And you told another one of a woman who sold her wedding ring on Craigslist so she could pay her utility bills. And I'm wondering, why do you think these kind of stories have not changed the debate in Washington?
Well, just think of how much time we spend telling the stories compared to how much time we spend telling Reverend Jones says, I'm going to burn the Quran story. You see, I think it's a proportion. I mean, we are all saturated with information. So there are exceptions in our journalistic enterprise. There are people who tell stories, but there are very few, and who don't have the kind of constant drumbeat that changes a conversation. At the Huffington Post, we have two reporters who are dedicated to doing nothing but telling stories. Literally, we are calling them our economic impact correspondents, and their job is to put flesh and blood on the data. Because I can sit here and give you all the data, 26 million people unemployed, underemployed, or discouraged to look for work, 3 million homes expected to be foreclosed, et cetera, et cetera. But if I can tell you the stories that I have in the book, if I can tell you about Brenda Carter, who had the same job in the same company for 11 years, and then she's fired one day and cannot get a job after years of trying, and is now making praline candy and selling it. First she was selling it door to door, now she's selling it online. You know, if I can give you a lot of detail about her, about what it was like to pick up all the little things that she had in her office for 11 years, you know, her pictures, her plants on one day, and the depression she went through. And, you know, that's how we connect with each other, through stories. And that's how we feel we can't let that happen.
But there's a political divide even in that story. I mean, some would say, oh, what a tragedy. They might be Democrats. Republicans would say, oh, what an entrepreneur. It's a happy story. Which is it?
Well, you know, here, that's a very good point you're making, because in my section on solutions, which is my favorite section, and if people only read one, I would recommend they read section 5, I actually say that this is a moment for us to reevaluate our lives, to tap into our own personal strength, because there are people who are crushed by economic hardship, whether it's a job loss, a home loss. And there are people like Brenda who, despite all the troubles, and she describes them in the book, has actually gone ahead. She's gotten her real estate license. She's selling cookies. I mean, God knows, I'm not glamorizing, and it hasn't been easy, and she's not making anywhere near what she was making in her safe middle-class job as an HR executive. But nevertheless, she is moving on, and she's doing things with her life. And absolutely, there are many, many stories like that. But if we tell them, we can encourage others to be inspired and move on rather than feel completely defeated.
Arianna Huffington, her new book is called Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. In her book, she says, Obama's audacity to win morphed into a timidity to govern. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Look at the top stories before we end this segment. We're waiting to see if that Florida church will go through with the plans to burn copies of the Quran. And the ruptured gas line in California that sent a blaze south of San Francisco and San Bruno has killed 6, the worst disaster in that town in history. Markets have opened flat. The S&P is up a fraction. The Dow is up a fraction. And the S&P also up a fraction. Discussions of the military today, whether we're talking about the don't ask, don't tell policy or the military weighing in on the Florida story that we've been following all morning. But American troops are now in full force in Afghanistan. The last regiment of the 30,000 troop surge has arrived. Over the next year, they hope to turn the tide against the Taliban. We've returned again and again to the situation on the battlefield in Afghanistan. Quentin Somerville, with our partner, the BBC, went along for the ride with the 101st Airborne, and he brought back some tape of what it's like. Here's Quentin Somerville.
The 101st Airborne are on the move. This regiment served in Normandy, Vietnam, and now its newest recruits are heading to Afghanistan. Privates Cosarilla and Gaskin said their goodbyes at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. They've barely been outside the US before. They're the last of the surge of 30,000 American troops arriving here. They hope to finish off the Taliban and end this 9-year-long war.
It's Quentin Somerville in embed with the 101st Airborne. Around 4,000 troops from the division are being stationed in Paktia province near the border with Pakistan, one of the most dangerous places in the world. Quentin traveled with them as they went on foot patrol down the dusty road in a small Afghan village.
We're just heading into the village of Zaruk. We're about 12 miles from the Pakistani border. And these troops know that they won't be able to stop the insurgents coming across that border, but they're hoping that with more regular patrols as a result of the extra troops from the surge, they can deter them, and that having these extra troops on the ground will make locals here feel safer.
And what do the troops themselves actually say?
The surge has brought Sergeant Cardwell to Afghanistan for a third time. On his return, he finds the Taliban are fiercer than ever before.
From when I was here the first time, back in 02, they had fought, it was the same guys who fought against the Russians and stuff like that, but now they've been fighting with the U.S. or, you know, coalition forces for almost 10 years now, and they definitely know how we fight and are more prepared than what they used to be.
Captain Henry Hansen also spoke with Quentin Somerville. He's from the 101st Airborne, and he took Quentin for a walk around the base. There were some surprises.
This is one of our towers. I kind of see the lay of the land. See where a couple of rockets have hit around this area, taking some enemy contact. Yeah, you can see we're kind of in a bowl here, surrounded by mountains. The enemy just likes to hang out around up there. But
the insurgents are firing from these hills over here.
All around.
All around.
Yep.
So when that siren goes, what do you do?
Well, the problem is we don't really have a siren. It's kind of just put out over the radio. And we have a set, drill that we do. Everybody gets to cover. We try and find where the fire is coming from. We have a couple different ways to do that. And then we just return fire with mortars usually. And they've been very successful here and counterfire missions killing the enemy. So something we want to keep up as well. Right here we got some more battle damage sustained on the cop. Indirect mortar round hit this trailer right here. You can see what kind of damage it does.
So I guess that landed
right on it.
Right on it.
Yeah. Yep. Landed right on it. It's kind of a fact of life around here dealing with the indirect.
The voice of Captain Henry Hansen from the 101st Airborne speaking with our BBC colleague Quentin Somerville. The threats in Afghanistan far from Florida pastors and political news conferences in Washington. The voices themselves in Afghanistan.
Good morning, Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Let's get a look at the headlines at 47 minutes after the hour. Florida pastor Terry Jones is saying his planned 9/11 Quran burning will not go forward. But he tells ABC's Good Morning America he believes Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf will move his Lower Manhattan Islamic Center.
Right now, we have plans not to do it. We believe that the Imam is going to keep his word, what he promised us yesterday.
But Imam Rauf and the center's planner says there's been a misunderstanding. They have no intention of moving the site. President Obama will hold a news conference at the White House later today at 11 o'clock. After talking about the economy for most of the week, he's expected to name Austin Goolsbee as the new chairman of his Council of Economic Advisors today.
And that gas fire in San Bruno, south of San Francisco, still blazing. It's killed six, destroyed a number of homes, the worst disaster in that city's history. And finally, 70% of Americans are overweight. New research says nearly a third of those overweight Americans think they're normal. Experts say the discrepancy explains why obesity is a growing problem in the U.S. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, let's look at another big story this morning. Very significant ruling out of a district court in California. The judge there ruled that the Pentagon's don't ask, don't tell policy is unconstitutional. U.S. District Court Judge Virginia Phillips wrote an 86-page opinion, says the policy does not preserve military readiness, contrary to what the Justice Department attorneys and many supporters have argued. The judge says evidence also shows the policy is, in fact, had direct and deleterious effect on the armed services. Joining us now is an active duty service member that we spoke to in May of this year. A Senate committee vote allowing the Pentagon to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, that's when we spoke to you the first time. A Coast Guard pilot with 10 years of military service, been serving in the armed forces, but unable to publicly reveal his sexual orientation. Good morning.
Celeste and John, good morning. Thank you for having me back.
So in light of this ruling, how would you feel about walking up to your commanding officer and revealing that you are gay?
Well, unfortunately, although this is a tremendous victory that a lot of people have worked a very long time to get, the policy still remains in effect, and there's still a long battle ahead of us that we will need to fight. So with that in regards, I don't have the option right now of walking up and expressing myself to anyone, unfortunately.
But if Judge Phillips puts an injunction in place, there's nothing anyone can do against you.
That is correct. However, I'm bound by the UCMJ, which is my rule book, so to speak.
But the court says, in fact, it's not. The Constitution is actually a higher law.
You are correct. You are correct. And like I said, this is a great victory for us, but there still is a significant battle ahead to deal with the appeals that may come down. And we're all anxiously watching the Senate right now with their decision, hopefully, with regards to Don't Ask, Don't Tell later this month.
I wanted to play you a comment from retired Army Colonel David Beatty. We spoke to him earlier this morning. He thinks Don't Ask, Don't Tell is actually necessary for the armed forces, and he talked to us about why he thought the judge made this ruling.
The military culture in and of itself is quite different than the culture that most judges live in. And although a judge can certainly understand that, I think that it's not something that is a matter of second nature.
He's saying that there are some things that civilian judges simply cannot rule on because they don't understand the way the military works. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I would in no way wish to discredit the colonel's 30 years of honorable service to this country. However, what I would like to express to him is that that culture or his service to the country over those 30 years may in fact be a weakness. Those 30 years encompass a significant cultural and attitude change in this country, and I feel that soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, and Coast Guardsmen of this country's armed forces, I think you should give them a little more credit with regards to what they are able to undertake when it comes to different cultures with regards to the military and civilian life.
We also had Jeffrey Rosen on. He's a George Washington University Law School professor, and he was explaining to us the ins and outs of this law. And I asked him about to explain the ways in which the don't ask, don't tell policy violates the Fifth Amendment. This is what he said.
The Fifth Amendment right that the court recognized in the Lawrence case said that people have a fundamental right of autonomy to define themselves. And in past cases, the court had said when the military is involved, you just defer and take their word for whatever they're saying. But the court said now in light of Lawrence, this right to autonomy is a fundamental right and it can't be trumped by the military. And the military has no special expertise about what is necessary for unit cohesion and so forth because of this basic right to autonomy.
What do you think? Do you think that this is just another ruling that's kind of eroding the special treatment of the military?
Well, I don't know if I would use the word eroding, but I think that this decision certainly bears light with regards to the forward movement of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Like I said earlier, we still have an uphill battle.
But wait a minute. I'm listening to your voice.
Sure.
The Constitution protects you. Everything about this decision says you are protected. What are you afraid of about coming out?
Because right now, I serve the military. I serve in the armed forces.
They can't touch you.
Well, that may be true, John, and you have a very valid point. However, when I put my hand in the air and I took an oath to support and defend the Constitution, I also gave up some of my rights, and I chose, or I didn't choose, but because of that, I am bound not only by the Constitution, but also by the UCMJ, which is the book that...
The Code of Military Justice.
But, you know, in listening to you talk about this dilemma, I mean, I can feel you on the horns of that dilemma. I don't think the difficulty, the dilemma of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy for active gay members has ever been so vividly characterized as what you just said right there.
You are correct. You are correct. And I am not the only one. There are countless others who feel the same way. And while this is indeed a victory, until we get the full green light from both sides, both the Constitution and the UCMJ, I think I'm going to have to be just a little cautious, as always, as we all do.
Really? Even if the Supreme Court weighs in?
Even if the Supreme Court weighs in, yes. Yes, I will be.
Okay, we are speaking to a Coast Guard pilot with 10 years of military service, an anonymous active duty service member that is currently serving in the military, unable to publicly reveal his sexual orientation. Thank you so much.
You bet, John Celeste. Thank you for your time.
Wow. Well, that's a lot to think about there. We've been talking from many different sides on this issue throughout the morning. You can catch them all by heading to our site, thetakeaway.org. You can leave a comment at the website. You can also call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And as you heard from that interview, you don't have to use your name. We've also been covering all your views on the Burn a Koran Day story hosted by that church in Gainesville, Florida. Currently on hold, the Koran burning is, as the pastor Terry Jones heads to New York. He says he'll meet with Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf. Of course, he calls him Iman. I don't know what that's about. The proposed cultural center and mosque near Ground Zero. However, the Imam has told The Takeaway he can't confirm a meeting will take place. But of course, you could tell us what you think.
They kill our soldiers, drag their bodies through the streets, burn our flag, burn Bibles, and everybody just shrugs it off and says, oh, they're just Muslim extremists. Well, let the preacher down in Florida burn the Quran, and we can just shrug our shoulders and say, oh, he's just a religious extremist.
Listen, if you give a party and nobody comes, you don't really have a party. By the same token, if the media totally ignored what this guy in Florida is or is not going to do tomorrow morning, then there couldn't be any insult to the Muslims with a picture of a Quran burning because there'd be no picture, no word, no nothing.
I am definitely against seeing these Qurans being burnt. However, at the same time, just as people are saying that it is the Muslims' right to build a cultural center wherever they want in the United States, I also believe that it's anyone's constitutional right to burn whatever book they want. Even if someone was burning the Bible, I'd be very upset about it, but it's their constitutional right. I don't see how one side can be wrong and one side can be right.
John from South Florida posts this to our site. He says he's learned a lot from all the coverage. I've learned that terrorism can be a two-way street. Your voices, your views, keep the conversation going at thetakeaway.org. And as we move into the weekend, you know, where will the Quran-burning addled media that Arianna Huffington described go next? Well, you know, there's got to be a network duel to the death race to talk to this character of the weekend.
Well, I think we should attack the funny-duddy attitudes of lower middle classes, which permit the establishment to survive
and keep the mores of the whole country back where they were in the 19th century and the ghastly days of the pre-sexual revolution.
What does the real Terry Jones, you know, the one from Monty Python, think of the Quran burning issue down in Florida? Perhaps that's about as much as this story actually deserves.
Does it have as much relevance? Yeah.
I think Monty Python can do an hour on this story. I think The Daily Show will do just an hour on Terry Jones down in Florida saying Iman instead of Imam.
It kind of opens them up for a little bit of ridicule,
I'll
don't
see
you
some
think?
Iman pictures, Iman? Maybe get David Bowie on the show. Who knows? If the real Terry Jones from Monty Python, though, weighs in or shows up at any Quran burnings over the weekend,
not likely.
You know that we will give you a full report on The Takeaway on Monday. Full
maybe
coverage.
Maybe featuring Iman.
Yes, indeed. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Have a great weekend.
The Iman has agreed.
Oh, now, you listen here. He's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy. Now, go away.
We have agreed to cancel our event on Saturday. And on Saturday, I will be flying up there to meet with him.
He's not coming up, and that's my final word.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.